This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to today's show. On today's show, we're going to answer several listener emails. The first one, I believe, being a question about making Roth contributions to your Thrift Savings Plan, or TSP. We've also got an email from a while back that was asking us, would a trust or a deferred income annuity be better to guarantee an inheritance of sorts? And then after this, after we get through those, we're also going to play our recorded interview with Barry James from James Investment Research. That interview played on our radio show here in Colorado, but we thought our podcast listeners, our iTunians, would enjoy that conversation. So we're going to play that here at the end after we answer these emails. So welcome to today's show. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Chris. Yeah, we're only going to get to two emails today. I guess we might be able to squeeze in a third if we go quick. We got seven emails last week. It was a very busy week of receiving emails. So I'm trying to whittle my way through those list of emails. And one of the emails, as I was whittling, I started going through my iPad, and I usually put little orange dots on emails that are questions, and that way, when I go to print them out, I can find them. And I found a little orange dotted email from August 10th.
Ooh.
And realized...
That was a while ago.
Yeah, I've never answered this one yet.
Maybe we should get to that one.
Maybe we should get to that one.
Hopefully they're still listening.
Seeing as it's September 30th when this plays.
Yeah.
So, what is that, almost 2 months behind schedule?
Well, only a month and three quarters.
But it's still better than the one from New Hampshire that I just outright lost. And got deleted.
Oh, but you found it or no?
No, this isn't New Hampshire.
Oh, that's too bad.
No.
Because
no.
I'm still aching to put a star on New Hampshire, but because of your...
No, you're screwed on New Hampshire. Yeah. There's no one.
Well, there's got to be another person, or maybe that person can send us the question again.
But that's what I keep pleading for, is for our
Please,
New Hampshire.
Please, New Hampshire.
Yes.
Reach out.
Reach out and touch someone. But we do have a email today from another state, so... would you like to get to that one first or the one that I totally forgot since August 10th?
We're going to cover both, but I already told people we're going to first talk about Roth contributions to a TSP. So which one is that?
That would be our new state.
Perfect. What
is the
new state?
So we do have a new state. We are finally getting people in and around Colorado to pay attention to us. We got an email from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Very good.
There's a lot of celebration needed. Whenever we put a new star on the map, and we're getting there. I think we only have 10 states left total.
Should we name them?
Sure. Just a quick recap, although I don't have a list. I'll have to just glance at the map. But the most obvious ones, the glaring omissions here.
Is New Hampshire.
We've got Maine and New Hampshire. We've got that we need. So people, if you're in Maine or New Hampshire or Delaware, we still need Delaware, believe it or not. Once we get those three, we'll have put stars on every state east of the Mississippi, except for the state of Mississippi. So I guess let's carve it off. East of the Mississippi, we need Maine, New Hampshire, Delaware, and Mississippi.
West of the Mississippi.
West of the Mississippi now, we need Louisiana, so right next door to Mississippi. We need Arkansas.
Also next door to Mississippi.
Yep. We need Nebraska, which is real close, North Dakota, Montana, Idaho, Nevada. That's it. That's and then it. We've got the entire United States covered with stars from people who have reached out
states.
To the Retirement and IRA Show
yes.
With a question or
now,
a comment.
The question becomes, because I know our iTunians are dying to know this, when you fill said map,
oh no,
what next?
I don't know. Now you're making me question my future. I don't know.
Should we break it down by counties?
No, no. This was hard enough getting these. No, we're not going to county level. No. I guess we could start putting multiple states. Then it could be like a competition between the states to which state could fill up enough, fill their state with the most stars. But that doesn't sound that attractive either. Because the more populous states would clearly...
Yeah, they would win.
Yeah.
You know, Wyoming. So we did get an email from Wyoming, but they don't have many people up there.
No, so that was an impressive one.
That was an impressive feat. Yes, exactly. Especially since Maine and New Hampshire have populations far greater than Wyoming and Delaware. But I bet you there's more people.
They're busy with other stuff, I guess.
Yeah, well, anyways, you need to start thinking of what you're going to do when said map gets filled. We're down to just 9 more states.
Okay.
You have to come up with something.
Of all the things I need to worry about, no.
Well, if we have any iTunian listeners, if you can come up with something else of what
idea.
Chris could play around with, of what we should do, should we... counties wouldn't work. I mean, that would be too many.
No. I don't know.
Remember
just
we had
open
that...
Up to suggestions.
We do have that iTunian who's trying to eat a blizzard, a Dairy King blizzard in every
Dairy
state.
Queen.
Dairy Queen.
Yeah. There
blizzard.
Is a Dairy King. Though.
Is there a Dairy King?
Yeah, but they're not as well known as Dairy
yeah,
Queen.
The Queen yeah. is much
the
more
Queen
well known.
Is, yes.
So maybe you could go on some sort of eating extravaganza.
Well, any kind of eating extravaganza is good for me. That sounds awesome. But also I could travel and call in and do the radio show or
and,
the podcast?
And eat a blizzard in every state.
Or calculate an IRA contribution or something in every state?
I don't know. We'll see. Know. But the Blizzard guy is getting there. But again, he did point out, which I did not know, there are no Dairy Queens in Vermont. So he's going to buy it in New Hampshire and drive across
well,
the border.
I'm glad he found a solution for
and
that.
And eat it in Vermont. Maybe he can send you a question while he is in New Hampshire buying his Blizzard. Would that count?
That'd be great. And then he could maybe drive to Maine and do the same thing.
Well, I think he already has Maine on his Dairy Queen quest. Okay, so let's get to our first email from our New Mexico listener. He begins, Jim, Chris, and Justin, greetings from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then he puts in parentheses, you're welcome, Chris.
I appreciate that.
Very
you
good.
Can't, I can't tell you how happy I am every time I get to put a star on the map.
And you get to play Hallelujah.
I do. It's just a wonderful day.
It is. I love the show and have learned more than I will probably ever need to know. I think what he's saying there is giving you a dig. You go too deep into your answers.
Me?
You. He's not referring to me.
Yeah.
If he is, I'll stop this question right here. My question is pretty simple, and I think I already know the answer, but I still want your opinion. So first, some background on me. I'm a 45-year-old married man. I work for the United States Postal Service. And have a thrift savings plan with approximately $300,000 in it. All traditional TSP contributions. Mm-hmm. Let's explain what that means.
Okay.
Traditional, a TSP is a thrift savings plan for iTunians who don't quite understand. And it's kind of like a 401k for the government. I mean, I'm dumbing it down, but it works very similar to a 401k, but it's for federal government employees. They put in... Now, I'm not sure on Postal Service, but non-Postal Service, if they're in the FERS program, which is a type of pension program for people hired after 87, if they put in up to 5% of their salary, the government will put in up to 5% of the salary. So there's a match in the TSP. They have very limited investment options. They're all indexed options, very, very low cost. They have 5 basic funds plus a series of what are known as L-share funds. And that's really what the government offers kind of in conjunction with their pension system.
Right.
When he says traditional, what he's saying, though, is it's operating outside of the Roth environment. In other words, he's putting in pre-tax dollars. The money he's putting in, he gets to deduct on his taxes. But when he retires and he takes it out, because TSP will be subject to... required minimum distribution rules, when he takes the money out, he will then have to pay the taxes. Right. So he's not he's kicking the tax can down the
deferring
road.
Deferring the income.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's what he means by all traditional TSP contributions. I currently contribute 20% of my $60,000 annual salary. I will be eligible to retire in 2028 at age 57. Gotta love government workers. So he put in his time, he's doing his hard work with the USPS, and they're going to allow him to retire at as early as age 57. But I plan on staying until 62 to maximize my pension, which will be about 40% of my highest 3 years' salary. I'm estimating that to be around $70,000, giving me a pension of about $28,000 per year. Mm-hmm. Now, we should point out to our listeners who don't know, the government's retirement system works in conjunction with Social Security. So he'll be receiving about $28,000 a year in pension, and I would say probably $20,000, $23,000 a year in Social Security.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing about that. Yep.
So both of those combined will be his pension, his retirement.
Which would be about 75% of his pre-retirement income.
Yeah.
Total between the two of them. And then he has the TSP.
And then he has his savings that can augment that.
Yes.
And what's good about it, it allows him to do it at 62. Now, he could retire as early as 57, but he wants more pension income, mm-hmm. so he's going to stay on for another 5 years and retire at 62. Okay, I am soon in a position to begin maximizing my TSP contributions of $18,000 per year. Once again, let me stop there and explain to our listeners what he's talking about. The TSP, again, is kind of like a 401k for government employees. They have the same contribution rules. $18,000 a year if you are under the age of 50. You can put a $6,000 a year catch-up contribution if you are over the age of 50. And that comes to what, 24,000. So he's 45. In another 5 years, he can put the catch-up if he wants. But what he's saying is things are changing, and he's going to have better cash flow, and he's going to be able to maximize or max out his TSP contribution of $18,000 a year. And then he goes on to write, my wife is 37 and unable to contribute to any type of retirement plan at this time, but that could change. I'm going to come back to that because the wife is eligible to contribute to a retirement plan. We'll talk about that in a minute. But right now, I'm guessing the wife who's 37 is a stay-at-home mom. That's what I'm guessing. He doesn't get on to say that. And she's 37 years old, and she cannot contribute to a retirement plan. And then he wrote, but that could change. Maybe it could change because she's going to go to work. Or perhaps she's working, but she's working for a company that doesn't offer a retirement plan. Either case, she will be able to make a contribution, and I'll explain how. Okay, so then he writes, I know I'm probably beating the horse to death, but here is my...
Did he really say that?
He...
Yeah.
He's making fun of you. No, he's not making fun. He's a long-time listener. No, he's from the East Coast.
No,
he's from New Mexico. Damn it.
No. He's saying it like you say it.
No,
on purpose.
He wrote, I know I'm probably beating the horse to death, but here's my question. Look at it.
Yes, I know.
Right there.
And you see how he highlighted it in his own sentence there?
He didn't put a little smiley face.
Oh,
he didn't put an exclamation point. I'm telling you, Chris, that's
people
a saying.
People from Albuquerque are very intelligent, and they know how to say these things. I promise you. Reach out to him and see. If Albuquerque says it the way you say it, then I'll owe everyone an apology.
He writes back and says, that's the way I've always said.
Mm-hmm.
For iTunes, a long-time listeners know what the hell Chris and I are talking about. I say beat the horse to death. He says beating a dead horse.
When he's talking about saying things over and over so much or handling an issue to the extent where there's nothing more to talk about and we're going on and on for no reason, that phrase is we want to stop beating the dead horse because it's over, it's fruitless, there's no reason to go on. He is saying it intentionally because he's addressing this letter to you. He's saying it your special way about beating the horse to death, which is clearly not allowed, nor something you want to try to describe.
He's my favorite iTunian.
I'm sure
now.
He is, especially if that's really how he says it. There's no way.
Okay.
I don't think there's any way. You're the only person I've ever met, ever. Ever.
Now we have two.
I still think you're still the only person. We'll see.
Anyways, he writes, I know I'm probably beating the horse to death, but mm-hmm. here is my question. Mm-hmm. Should I stop making Roth TSP contributions now? And what percentage should I contribute to each? I am considering $12,000 per year in the traditional and $6,000 per year to the Roth. But since I already have $300,000 in traditional, should I choose a different strategy? I know there are a million things to consider, and this is just one decision I'm facing, but I could use some help. Your fan, and he writes his real name, but as always, we are going to call him George.
Just what I always wanted, my own little bunny rabbit. I will name him George, and I will hug him and pet him and squeeze him.
I'm not a bunny rabbit.
So George, who is my favorite iTunian.
So far.
Until
you find out he's making fun of you.
I don't think he's making fun of me. He put a little smiley face in there if he was making fun of me.
He's being playful with you. I'm pretty sure.
We'll see. Mm-hmm. George, you know who you are. Please write back to me and let me know if you wrote, I'm probably beating the horse to death specifically to make fun of the man who's about to answer your question for free. Or if you did that to point out to Chris that that is a viable saying.
It is not a viable saying. Okay.
We'll soon find out.
Oh, we will.
He'll write back, uh-huh. or I'll never answer his question again.
Well, you'll already have answered it. So,
but if he asks another,
he'll just write in under a different name.
I still think he would have used the smiley face to show that he's making fun
we'll
of me.
See. That button might be broken on his computer.
Okay, before I answer that, I want to get back to where he wrote his wife is 37 and unable to contribute to any type of retirement plan. It's going to be because of one of two reasons. She's a stay-at-home mom, or she works for an employer who doesn't offer one. Other than that, there's no rule against 37-year-old people from being able to contribute mm-hmm. to a retirement plan.
Even if they make too much, tons and tons of money.
There'll still be something they can contribute to. So when he wrote that, I just want to point out, because she's married, let's just assume the first option. She's a stay-at-home mom. She doesn't have a job. She doesn't have earned income. So she can't contribute to an employer-sponsored plan because there is no employer. She can put money into an IRA as a spouse. It's called a spousal IRA. Now, that's not a special IRA. She's not going to go somewhere and say, I want to open a spousal IRA. She's just going to open an IRA, either a Roth or a traditional, and she can put money in up to her limit. She's 37, so she could put $5,500 in. So whatever amount up to $5,500 she can put in. Because she is married to you, George, and as long as you earn more than $5,500, which you already said, you earn about $60,000, she can do. Mm-hmm. So she can contribute to a spousal IRA. If she has an employer, in other words, she's working, she just doesn't have an employer plan, then she has two options. She can petition the employer to start offering a plan, but that might run into a dead end. Thank you. I knew you ran into a dead end.
Nor a dead horse.
Not a dead. Well, you could run into a dead horse if it was beaten to death. But I knew it wasn't a wall. I was ready for you to hop on me on that one. Yeah. But she could run into a dead end. And what she could do in the case of an employer plan is on her own earnings contribute to an IRA. Because she has earnings. She just doesn't have an employer plan. If she's not covered by an employer plan, she wouldn't even be subject to limitations on the deductibility of her contributions. Now, the spousal IRA, she may be subject to, she will be subject, and I don't have them open in front of me, what the earnings amount as a married couple can be in order for her to deduct the spousal IRA contributions. But I still think at $60,000 of income, she's well under mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
But on the employer side, if she doesn't have an employer plan, the government doesn't limit your ability to deduct those contributions. So she could contribute to a traditional IRA if she'd like as a spouse, or an employee without an employer plan, or she'd be able to contribute to a Roth option. And that takes us to the general question he has. It's, hey, over the next few years, I'm 45. I want to work to 62. So he's going to work for, what does that come to, another 17 years. Mm-hmm. Should I be contributing to the traditional option or to the Roth option? That's really what, in essence, he's asking. Okay, I wanted to help him and his wife out on that, though, to let him know that she can contribute. As far as the second or main part of the question, should he be contributing to the Roth option, and if so, how much? I would begin by saying yes, there should be some money. I'm a little unsure exactly how much money, but there should be some going into the Roth option. Because remember, listeners, the traditional option, which he has, is always going to be money that will be subject to all the rules of having, even though this is a TSP, they are going to have the same rules as any IRA has, required minimum distribution rules, rules when money is removed, rules when money is inherited. And right now, he has $300,000 in a TSP. He has very little what we call tax diversification. I want to go back to what I mentioned on a previous show not too long ago, that when we work with people, we break their assets down. You know, you see typical asset allocation breakdowns, Chris, on investing, and then you see net worth breakdowns when you look at people's assets as a whole. That's typical in the industry. We go one step further. We give you a projection of where you are now and where we feel you will be at age 70 in the taxability of your assets. And there's only three options they can fall into, Chris. Assets whose distributions are going to be always taxable, maybe taxable, or never taxable. By that, I mean income taxable. There's no middle ground. The money is always going to be subject to income taxes, maybe subject to income taxes, or never subject to income taxes. Right now, all his money is going into always taxable.
True, but the one thing that he's got is, and this is what leads me to my ultimate recommendation, which is to make a tax plan, really look at the whole story and how he sees things evolving up to and through his retirement, and what are these, maybe these tax time bombs that might be created, and taking steps to avoid those. But he does have a situation where he says he's retiring at 62, which is 8 full years before RMDs kick in, and 8 years where a person could delay their Social Security benefits and take advantage of that time to drain these tax-deferred accounts at maybe favorable tax rates before the RMDs kick in. But if you get the tax-deferred, these income-deferred monies, like in the TSP, the traditional style, too large, you're going to have too much to get out during that time period.
The one issue I would throw out there, if we were working with him, is we have to look at his FERS pension. Mm-hmm. And there's no, after he gets his pretty much to his maximum pension level at 62, and they could change the law between now and then, just like they entice you to delay Social Security, maybe they'll entice him to keep delaying his TSP. But if he didn't...
His FERS.
Mm-hmm. If he didn't delay it, he is going to have that $28,000 in today's dollars coming in.
But only that. So he still is going to be...
He'll still have some.
It won't be as glorious of a tax window or tax opportunity as if he could, as when he could shut it off completely, all this income that would be taxable, like for someone who only has Social Security, where they, by deferring it, essentially shut off all taxable income, and then they can play around with the taxability of distributions.
Well, let's go...
He doesn't have quite that flexibility, but he has what a lot of people don't have, 8 full years of doing this.
From 62 to 70.
62 to 70.
Because 70 is the longest he would defer his Social Security, and his required minimum distributions will begin at 70 and a half. So what we're describing to you, listener, which I'm sure you know already, is what we call the tax planning window. And that's from the period of time you retire, 62, to the period of time you reach 70 and a half, where you are in control, not the government, on if you're going to turn on Social Security and if you're going to take money out of your always taxable accounts. That would be your TSP and your IRA, the traditional ones. And usually during that time period, you can manipulate your income, keep it low, and start taking money out of those accounts and either living on it or converting it to a Roth. But therein lies some of the problem, Chris. If he continues to grow everything in the TSP plan, he already has $300,000 in it. If he continues to save money in the TSP option, he's still going to need some money to make up the difference between what the TSP, the FERS pension will cover and what he's going to need to live on. And remember, FERS works in conjunction with Social Security. And even though he can delay his Social Security, will that be enough, or is he going to have to turn Social Security on earlier? But he's going to have very little opportunity. Let's just say he can defer his Social Security. He's not going to be able to live on $28,000 in today's dollars. That would be the equivalent of going from $60,000 a year today to $28,000 a year. Mm-hmm. That's a big drop. That's a 50% drop in income. If he can't live on that, where's he going to make up the difference? If he doesn't have enough money in a Roth to draw out during this time period, in other words, he can draw from the Roth and convert assets and keep his tax window low, he better save in a never tax or maybe taxable account, a regular brokerage account. He shouldn't still plug everything, in my opinion, into the TSP. He's going to need some money to live on during that 8-year period where he might be able to benefit from converting. He's still going to need some money to live on so he can convert and not fill his bucket where converting no longer makes sense. Am I explaining that right? I know in my mind I'm envisioning it.
Well, it plays the specifics of having different things, what exactly you're going to have in these different tax classifications, if you will, is just bringing out the point of creating tax diversification. If you paint yourself into a corner, which is a saying that I don't know that you've used, and do you have a version of paint yourself into a corner?
No, I've heard of that before.
And do you use that in the traditional manner, or do you paint in some other way?
No, I use that like you just kept painting, and now you're in the corner, you can't get out until the paint dries.
Really? Your version is the same?
It is.
Wow. That's awesome. So if you paint yourself into a corner by having all of your retirement monies in the same type of taxable account or no taxable, I guess, and that really wouldn't paint yourself into a corner if you don't owe tax on anything, but you may have created a situation where you paid more tax than you need to. But having the flexibility to adapt and adjust every year depending on what your tax situation turns out to be. When you've painted yourself into a corner and have all your monies in an always taxable account, you don't have that flexibility. Bottom line, you'll end up paying more in taxes than what you otherwise could. And who wants to do that? Because the more you pay in taxes just means the less that you get to spend on things you want to do in retirement. So that's why we have this recommendation, this general recommendation, to create for yourself tax diversification. Have money in these different types of accounts, these different types of, even more, a better word than accounts might be, different types of situations. Because some of this money may not be in an account. It might be some kind of income stream that you're expecting. But have monies available in different tax exposures, if you will, so that in any given year, you can have some adaptability to maximize your situation. That's really what it is.
No, I agree fully. The only thing I would encourage him to do, because he wants to know how much, and his idea, again, was to put $12,000 a year in traditional, $6,000 in the Roth. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with that, but maybe he could switch it around, put $12,000 in the Roth and $6,000 in the traditional, because he already has $300,000 in the traditional. It's going to take a long time to catch up to that.
Plus, the federal government's going to be putting in their 5% into the traditional. None of their money ever goes in the Roth.
None of theirs ever goes in the Roth.
Even if all of his monies from here forward get directed to the Roth option, 5% of his income is still going to be going into the traditional account, which has already got 300,000 in it.
Right. And that'd be about another $3,000 because the man's making about $60K a year. The government's going to match 5% of his salary if he puts 5% in. And that's always going to go into the traditional TSP. So if he puts in 12 and the government's putting in 5, that's 17,000 a year. And he's only putting 6,000 a year into the Roth option. That's less than half. So I'm just saying to switch that pot around would be my thought process. But if he did an actual tax plan, and you might be able to find an advisor there in Albuquerque, New Mexico, or we do this. Again, I'm going to give a shout out to our services. We do work with people throughout the country. What you need to do is start projecting what are the value of these retirement accounts going to be and your income. That is what's key, because I'm trying to determine what's giving him more value right now, Chris. I got to look at his income situation right now. He's making $61,000 a year. He doesn't tell us if his wife is working or not. I'm thinking that maybe she's a stay-at-home, but I don't know. She could be making $200,000 a year for a startup that doesn't have a retirement plan yet, and their income could be near $250,000. Or she could be a stay-at-home mom, and they're living on $60,000, and they've got a few kids. So from a tax perspective, they're paying maybe 10, 12% taxes. What good is a tax deduction now if he's only in a 10 or 12% level? In retirement, he's not going to have his kids as a deduction. He's going to have a nice pension. He's going to have Social Security. He's going to have massive RMDs, and he could be in a higher bracket. Mm-hmm. So there's not enough information here for me to make this determination. I need a little more information on what the wife is earning. I need a little more information on what his overall tax rate is now, not what bracket he's in, but what is his effective rate right now, and then we got to project what is his effective rate going to be in the future. Of course, conversions in the future are at the marginal rate, so we have to be able to see if he converts in the future. Is he going to be in a marginal rate higher than his current effective rate? Is it worth it or not? So there's a lot of moving parts here we have to evaluate. I'm trying to give him ideas of things to look at, but he needs a tax plan. You need to look at this situation a little clearer, and I need a little more information on the wife. Again, does the wife not have a retirement account because she's a stay-at-home mom and they're only living on $60K? Or I have clients who are working for tech startups. They don't have any type of retirement plan, Chris, but they have some amazing stock options on a company that's not worth anything now, but if it takes off, that's their that's why they work for a startup. So is she working for a startup that could be increasing? What's her situation right now? But there's a lot of moving parts for me to say this is what you should do. I do say your approach seems reasonable. Spread it out, start growing your never taxable pool, but I will quickly change my mind on that if his wife is a stay-at-home mom, their effective tax rate is 10% or less, or even 12% or less, and a quick calculation shows me between TSP, RMDs, and Social Security, they're going to be in a much higher bracket in the future. It might not behoove them to be getting a tax deduction right now. Right. Instead, put all of it in the Roth.
In the Roth. Right.
And the government match will continue in the TSP.
Yep.
I need to divine a little bit more, and that's why you need a tax plan.
Yep.
But you can do this tax plan yourself. You can hire a good advisor to help you. This would be someone who is good at looking and making these type of forward-looking projections, or you can contact our office. We'll explain how working with us would work. But I think I answered it enough. Mm-hmm. I really can't give him a definitive answer, but I'm just trying to give him some ideas to think of.
Yeah, did a nice job.
Does that work? All right.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So that was that one.
The next question, we'll try to be enthusiastic. I'll try to be enthusiastic about it, but it's not from a new state, so I don't get to put the
No, star but you got to be happy because he emailed it to us a long time ago, August 10th.
Well, I'm sad for him then.
And if you didn't remind me that I had this email, we would have never lost it. So you're already in the doghouse with this guy.
For pointing it out. Sorry. We could have just completely ignored it.
But let's, because we are recording just a podcast, if we could take a break so I can go grab some water.
Oh, you want a break?
So just we'll stop recording and I'll come back.
So we'll take a short break here on the Retirement and IRA Show. So
we'll
your break will be about 30 seconds. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. Hope we didn't lose you over that short break. Like I mentioned before we get to this next email question, I want to remind you that at the end of this answer to this particular email, we're going to replay our recorded interview with Barry James from James Investment Research. That interview appeared on our local radio show here in Colorado, but we thought it would be found interesting to those of you out there in, podcast land. Yeah, for the do-it-yourselfers, which I know there's a lot of you that listen to the podcast. So email number two from today's show, as Jim mentioned before, it's
we do,
a little
delayed. But
before
we get into it, I want to talk to our iTunians for a minute because this is our iTunian-produced podcast. If you haven't noticed, we broke apart the Colorado radio show, and we pulled that out of the iTunes podcast. We're trying to cut down on some of our banter and Colorado updates that we give that our iTunians never really wanted to listen to. And we're trying to design our podcast geared more towards our iTunians and more towards a Q&A, question and answer, because we get a tremendous amount of emails. I told you we got 7 emails this week, Chris, and here we are about to answer. Essentially, we only answered one because the second email was sent in August. We just never got to it until now. So one of the things is that next week is our first, 2 weeks.
Right. Next week we're going to test it, but no one's going to be able to hear it live. But we are going to test the online broadcast system for our podcast to go in the live, truly live, where you can call in and ask us questions while we are recording. At this point, of course, you can only do that while we are you can send us questions, but they're by email, and then we get to them later, sometimes much later.
Right, so today is Monday, September 25th, that we're recording. This will be on iTunes probably this coming weekend, Saturday the 30th. So then we'll be recording next Monday, October 2nd. That will be our test. You're still going to hear the exact same iTunes podcast that you currently are listening to. We'll be answering some email questions, but we'll be testing our broadcasting software. Then yours truly is going elk hunting. So, this is going to be a problem. I just realized I'm not here on the 9th.
Yeah, I know. You warned me of that before.
Yeah, I'm going to be out elk hunting. Now, it is possible I get my elk on opening day like I did last year. I did last year.
I know.
So that would mean I would be home by Sunday. I would be leaving Friday the 6th and home by Sunday the 8th because opening day is Saturday the 7th. And I could be back in the studio for Monday the 9th. But if hunting is more like hunting usually is, I probably won't have anything by then. So are you and Junior going to answer some questions?
That's
or
up to you.
We're gonna have to figure something out.
Yeah.
But
so it may not be till the 16th.
It may not be till the 16th. But what we want to remind our iTunians on is that Monday afternoons around 2 p.m. Mountain Time, you will be able to go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Right on the homepage, kind of near the top is where they're looking to put it, is going to be a streaming icon. I've seen it already. It's not too bad. It's kind of easy to find. It's going to be next to the blue cup we have on the homepage. And it'll be flashing or a different color, but it'll say listen now or on air now, some sort of button like that. You click that and you'll be able to hear us as we are recording the podcast. And the intent, we're going to keep answering email questions, but the intent is, since it's now live and you're listening to it, if you want to actually pick up the phone and call us, you'll be able to pick up the phone and call in and get in the queue, and we will actually answer and talk to you live on the air and answer your question right away, Chris, instead of just limiting people to emails. So that's why the name of the show is being changed to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A, whereas the Colorado version is the Retirement and IRA Show Colorado Edition. Once we start getting to this point, we're probably not going to put the Colorado show at the end of our podcast anymore, Chris, unless it's something very interesting like today's show with Barry James was. But I don't want to bore our iTunians with our Colorado-themed show. Like, we're going to be talking about Colorado Para shortly on that show. People in California could care less about Colorado Para.
True.
So we won't even bother putting that on. But these are all the exciting changes that are happening. We're testing it next week. We may or may not be doing it on the 9th. Right now, I'd have to lean towards no. Every time I've ever been elk hunting, it's taken me 3 or 4 or 5 days to get my elk. Last year was an anomaly. I knew I could get that one. Last year was an anomaly, and I got the elk on opening day. It's never happened before and may never happen since. But hopefully I will have an elk because I'm running low on meat in my freezer. Okay, so anything else you want to add?
No.
In addition to that? Okay.
Just I'm hoping this email is shorter.
It is. This will be a quicker question.
You've burned through a lot of time here on this show.
Well, we had to talk to our iTunians. We hadn't talked before.
No, I understand.
All right. So, number two, question
You're
two.
48 minutes and we've covered one email.
You done?
I'm just letting you know.
Well, if you weren't wasting this time telling me that, we could have been halfway through this email.
Go ahead.
All right. It begins, Jim, Chris, and Junior. Where's Junior when we need him?
Yeah.
Jim,
if he's going to be called out, we're going to have to make him come in here.
Jim, Chris, and Junior. Junior, for those who don't know, is Justin Fundalinski. He has been working with Chris and I for 3 years, and he's becoming a more regular part of the radio show. We hopefully be able to get him on more. But he works with us here in the office. He's our junior planner. He writes, not Justin, but the listener writes, I anticipate that sometime over the next 5 to 10 years, my mother will pass away, leaving her investments to us. My sister lives nearby and provides care for my mom on a daily basis. She and her spouse make the least of all of us given their career choices. They've also not been the best at money management. So since I really won't need my inheritance, I've been considering whether there might be some way to turn at least a portion of my inheritance into an income, into an income stream for them when they retire. And then he put, assuming my wife agrees to all this. My thoughts up to this point have mostly been along the lines of utilizing a deferred income annuity, but I was also wondering if a trust might be the best for me in terms of assuring that the money stays as an income stream and can't be taken out all at once. Since the amount involved would likely be around $100,000, would a trust make any sense? If not, what is the minimum threshold for it to make sense? And he put in parentheses, I could potentially talk to other siblings to increase to that amount. So I guess asking his other brothers and sisters to, you know, why don't we all
So this is it's a situation that people actually oftentimes face not with siblings, but rather with children, where they're wanting to create some benefit for them in the future. But strings attached where the children, in the traditional case, can't just drain the account or cash things out or whatever it is. So this has got a little bit of a difference compared to what might be considered a traditional story here, where they're actually have these concerns with siblings. They'd like to help the siblings out, essentially deflecting the inheritance that would normally be coming to them, which he's admitted they don't really need, deflecting it to siblings who could, who need it more, but not turning the reins over to them. Just he's obviously not wanting to just say, no, Mom, give them all the money instead, because he's worried about them blowing it all, essentially, like you might with a spendthrift child.
And there's going to be pros and cons to all of this, as there always are in anything generally finance related that he's got going on here. And I mean, now as I read through this question again, I how much time do I have?
You have as much time as you have to take, but I'd like you to take no more than 9 more minutes.
9 more minutes might be pushing
it. Okay, 12.
What I'm getting at is, first of all, let's back up here. Mm-hmm. You said you saw this a lot, or we see it a lot in the case with children, where parents want to make sure their children get an income stream and don't blow the money. I agree fully with that. But I also see it a lot with parents with multiple kids. What he doesn't get to, do all these kids live right next to Mom, or is only one child next to Mom and everyone else has relocated across the United States? So there are this one child, in this case the sister, who's doing all the work, so to speak, taking care of the mother. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times parents want to reward that child mm-hmm. with more.
True.
Because they recognize caring for an elderly person is not easy.
And costly to them.
And costly to them, because as this listener has even written, that now he does say that they earn less given their career choices. What he doesn't tell us were the career choices. We're going to stay close to Mom so I can take care of her, and I'm going to take this lower paying job so I have a lot of free time. Or was the career choice, hey, you know, we're going to go follow the Grateful Dead around for, you know, 16 years and do nothing. We don't know. And I'm not passing judgment on which reason it is. The fact of the matter is, the sister is taking care of the mother most. We've often seen in my own practice, the parent acknowledge this and the other children agree. Mm-hmm. Yes, so-and-so is taking care of Mom more. Leave more to them. Because here's one of the issues. If this hasn't been brought to the mother's attention, if the mother continues, and he doesn't say how many kids there are, let's just say there's 5 to make this easy, and each child's going to get 20% of the inheritance, and he said it'll be about $100,000, so let's say there's $500,000. So they're each going to get $100,000. Mm-hmm. Now, if they all receive it, once the inheritance is paid out, first of all, without using a trust, there could be some estate and probate issues, so we have to recognize that. Just because the mom has $500,000 doesn't mean the kids will end up with $100,000 each. There's going to be probate costs. There's going to be estate issues. There could be estate debts that have to be paid off first. The mother might spend the last year of her life in a nursing home, or the last 6 months of her life in a hospital, and run up massive bills that are not paid by Medicare or Medicaid. So just because the money is there, we don't know if it will be. But let's just assume it does make it. Mm-hmm. If it goes to each individual child, it makes it through probate, it makes it through the estate, there's no creditors taking it, nobody argues the probate costs are low, and $100,000 goes to each of the 5 children, it could get stuck there. There could be not estate issues, but there could be debt issues. There could be credit issues mm-hmm. at each level. A child who today says, yes, Mom, I'm going to make sure some of my money that you send me goes to take care of Mary. Let's just pretend that's the name of the sister. But once Mom dies and the money is actually there, that sibling may all mm-hmm. of a sudden need all $100,000. And
or
without a trust,
be tempted to spend it on themselves.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And he even wrote, assuming my wife assumes this is okay. Remember, he wrote mm-hmm. that. He said, assuming my wife agrees. What if all 4 other kids may agree they're going to take some of their inheritance, maybe $20,000 each, and leave the woman who's taking care of the mom $180,000 and they get $80,000 each? Maybe they all agree that's fine, but their spouses aren't going to be too copacetic on that, or their children. Mm-hmm. So what they agreed to today will all of a sudden melt right. away into arguments. We see this a lot. Yeah.
So I think that is very key to in looking at this strategy. It's not all about how to get the dollars to where you want it specifically. It's how to minimize the chance for family strife. This the last thing the mom is going to want to leave behind are siblings that maybe used to get along, but now there's friction or even outright animosity because of a money issue. A money issue. And I like where you're going with this because I agree that I think this should be solved at the mother level, at that generation, not at let's give it to the siblings maybe evenly, and then they're going to form some kind of pact to some of them are going to give a little extra money to Mary and others may not and that sort of thing. I think that discussion should be had now, maybe even openly, with the mother, and a proper estate plan. Even if it's not a broad-based, we don't know anything about the rest of her situation. So maybe she needs one. Maybe this could be addressed with one document where the mother defines Mary's going to get this and all the other, and she's open with the other siblings, telling them why she's doing this. Sounds to me like if all the other siblings are much more well-off financially, they might all feel exactly the same way. You know, absolutely, Mary should get a lot more than we do. We really don't need it. Maybe, you know, take all of ours. We don't want any of ours. And then the mother could form a plan properly, and a proper estate plan that will accomplish that, and that it'll take what you are worried about off the table. It essentially addresses it now. It's open. Mother gets what she wants. Mary hopefully gets what she deserves.
The only problem, yeah. again, what he doesn't get into, he says doesn't tell me about his mom's health, doesn't tell me about her mental well-being. Mm-hmm. Can the mom make legal decisions on her own?
True.
And will she be able to understand a lot of what we're sharing? And a lot of older people don't want five kids. And again, in my example, there's five kids. I don't know if there's 2, 3, 4, 5, 27. We don't know if it was a Catholic family. I don't know how many kids there are. But all coming up to mom and saying, hey, mom, we got to put a trust in place with your inheritance so we can make sure Mary, who's taking care of you, gets her fair share. And the mother might be, whoa, wait a minute. And she may not want to talk about it. So we see.
Or may not agree.
Or may not agree. But there's a lot of moving parts here. And what I don't know is that it's always best to handle this at the mother level. But if it can't be handled at the mother level, any agreement between siblings, the more siblings there are, the greater the chance. It probably works exponentially.
The number of problems increases.
Correct. That's the word I want.
Exponentially.
Exponentially.
Yes.
Cool. So that word. It is the more kids, the more problems. It's exponentious.
Exponentially.
Exponentially.
Yeah. So instead of, yes.
Is it exponentious a word?
No, that's not a word. No. Not, at least not in English.
So it multiplies.
Yes.
The more kids, the more problems. And the more likely one or two of them will back out. They may tell you now, yeah, we're going to do this. But later they may not. Mm-hmm. The other thing he doesn't tell me, are these qualified or non-qualified assets? In other words, listener and listeners, is this inheritance coming to you via an IRA? Most retirees have their assets in retirement accounts. Now, it's quite possible the mother doesn't. Maybe the inheritance is farmland or something. But if it's a qualified account, now you're looking at a tax situation. Mm-hmm. Because let's just assume, again, $500,000 in an IRA. In my first example, it wasn't an IRA. Now it's an IRA. So now each child inherits $100,000 in an IRA. And our iTunian listener starts saying to the other four children, hey, remember, take out $20,000 and give it to Mary. Take out $20,000, give it to Mary. Well, they take out $20,000. They now have to declare it as income mm-hmm. and pay taxes on right. it.
And they already said, he already admitted that they all have much higher paying careers
than Mary.
So the better, the more tax efficient method.
Give
it to Mary in the first
at
place.
At the mother level mm-hmm. through a beneficiary designation.
Yep.
If all of you are going to agree, and again, you're saying you're going to get about $100,000 each. I'm just saying maybe 20% each. And again, I'm making these numbers up, but if there's five of you each inheriting $100,000, that gives Mary $180,000 and gives all of you $80,000. And Mary now has $180,000 in an IRA that is paid out to her. I'll get into a minute how to make sure Mary doesn't blow the money. But what this will allow you to do is save on taxes. Mm-hmm. You're not being forced to take $20,000 out. Or I can guarantee you, if this is all qualified money, the first high earner is going to say, no, I'm not doing this. Mary will, I'll give her $1,000 a year. I'll take it out. Right. And give it to her that way. I'm not going to declare $20,000 as income to give it to Mary. Conversely, you cannot transfer it to Mary. If you, now you could, let me back up, beep, beep, back up a little. If you inherit this through an IRA, they could disclaim the first 9 months of death, if they all, if he can pin everyone down and get everyone to agree, and remember, it moves help me out here.
Chances for problems.
What again?
Exponentially.
Exponentially. So you got five people in this. It's now going to be a very difficult thing. But if within the first 9 months of your mom passing away, you could disclaim, let's again say 20%. They all five kids are going to agree that Mary gets an extra 20%. All four, Chris, the four remaining kids, Mary's the fifth, all four could disclaim 20% of their IRA and say, we don't want it. We want just 80% of our IRA inheritance. You can do a qualified disclaimer. There's a lot of rules involved in it, but it has to be done within 9 months. And now, Mary, you cannot, if you disclaim, you cannot say where it goes.
Right.
It has to go to the next beneficiary in line. So it would take all four kids agreeing to disclaim. Mm-hmm. Because if not, the custodian can't say, okay, we're going to skip this kid and give it all to Mary. Whoever doesn't disclaim, they get to share in part of the money you want to leave Mary. So disclaiming is not an easy way of doing this.
No.
And if he, and I highly doubt he's going to be able to get all kids to agree to disclaim.
That's why if the mother could do,
do it
up front proactively
on the beneficiary
just define
form.
It, you don't have to, when you have multiple beneficiaries, they don't all have to be equal beneficiaries. You can write on that, write on the designation form, the beneficiary designation form, say so-and-so gets 20%. So-and-so's sister, you know, you name them on there. It has to be, you actually name them. You know, you don't say each brother or anything like that. The more specific you can be, the better chance you have of it not getting messed up.
Right.
So you want to be very specific. You name it right in there. You can even name dollar amounts. Those aren't usually recommended because who knows what the account balance is going to be when it actually goes, but you have that flexibility. And so, yeah.
Now, if it's just one or two other siblings, and let's just say it's him, another brother, and the sister, and him and his other brother agree they want to do this, a disclaim will be very easy.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he disclaims and the other brother disclaims, the money has to go to the next beneficiary in line. That would be the sister. She obviously isn't going to disclaim, and boom, it's all there.
Mm-hmm.
But you start getting four or five people involved all trying to disclaim. Another one says no. Then they have to get part of that disclaimed amount.
And then talk about Thanksgiving dinner that year.
Yeah, that's
right. That money that was supposed to go to Mary ends up going to Tommy because he forgot or refused
to disclaim. Right.
So he didn't just get his regular share. He got
the disclaimed
more.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's
so
going to be very uncomfortable.
You got to be careful on the disclaiming. But if there's only one or two of years, disclaiming might work. One or two years.
Okay.
I don't know how many. There could be three or four, but in my example, there's one or two.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand. You get that.
No, it's okay.
You got that look on your face again. Now I know I said something wrong.
No. It just reminds, you know, we're going along and then suddenly just smacks me in the face. Man, he's from Boston.
Oh, yes.
Yes. 2 years. 2 years go down to Dunkin' Donuts, get us a coffee.
Use guys. Yeah. I know. We say that all the time. Use guys.
It's cute. You know, being out west here, we don't hear that very often.
No. But, okay, so back to this situation, listener. So a couple of things you got to pay attention to. Is the money qualified or non-qualified? If it's qualified, if it's in an IRA, a 401k, a TSP, if it's in anything like that, it needs to be done with a beneficiary form, or you're going to have a major tax issue as you guys are trying to give this extra money to your sister. It would be very beneficial if the mother was to do it at her level with the beneficiary form. If it's non-IRA assets, it's going to be a lot easier. There's no disclaiming. Let's just assume that you do face an issue, though. As you said, your spouse or another spouse of any of the siblings may ixnay any agreement you have today. One of the spouses may have a debt or a creditor problem, and the inheritance is all of a sudden lost to that. So they're not giving Mary anything, and his good intents may blow up. So again, if the mother was to agree to this, here's my thoughts. A trust. Is there enough money for a trust? I don't know, because he only says his share of the inheritance is $100,000. And let's just assume Mary's share is $100,000. So we know there's at least $200,000 here. I don't know how many other siblings there are. Mm-hmm. One, so are we talking $300,000 or 10, and we're talking $1 million. So we don't know on that situation. But even if it was just you and one other person plus Mary, so $300,000 in assets, a trust is going to make this happen. So no one can back out. No one can change their mind. None of your spouses can pipe in, well, we're not giving them anything. I don't care. I never liked Mary anyways. None of that stuff can happen. If your mom agrees to this, can mentally understand what's being proposed, can understand what the trust is going to do, all the assets pay to a trust. And then you don't even have to worry about dollars. It can simply say, at the end, I want to make sure Mary, who has taken care of me, is given 20% more than everyone else. Because we don't know what the inheritance is going to be. Maybe it won't be $100,000. Maybe it'll be $130,000. Or maybe it'll be $50,000. Mm-hmm. So you can't do it by, if it's 50 and you've all agreed to leave 20, now you're giving almost 40% of your inheritance away. So you don't want to do it by dollars. You're going to want to do this by percents. The trust can be set up and could have language in there that as long as Mary adequately takes care of the mother, in other words, she doesn't abscond with the pool boy and run away, that she actually has to stay there and take care of the mother, that we agree or the mother agrees to leave 20, 25, 30% more. I've seen this. We've done this in the office, not us personally because we're not attorneys, but Pete has put language together to ensure that. Then once you write the trust can be written in a way, listener, with you and the other children who do not have these money issues, do not have these spendthrift issues. Remember, he wanted to be adamant Mary got income because if she got the lump sum, she'll blow it. And that's a very admirable thing he wants to do. He wants to make sure Mary has that. So the trust can be written in such a way that Mary's portion has spendthrift protections and everyone else's doesn't. So it can then pass through to everyone else. Or it could be toggled. If Pete was here, he'd explain. The trustee decides, gee, this person is going through a divorce. No, we don't want to pass that on right away. That's protected. This one has no problems. I'll pass that one on. Mary, that definitely has the spendthrift protection. All these little options, it's kind of like buying a car. All these little fancy options you add to the trust will increase the cost. But I think a trust of this magnitude, remember, the trust has nothing to do with the amount of assets, listener, because it's not being funded until your mom's passing. This is called a testamentary trust, created during life, funded at death. So there's no dollar amount in here. Whether your mom has $10 million or $100,000, the attorney's going to charge the same. It's all the attorney's time he or she is going to spend writing all these provisions. Mm-hmm. So it has nothing to do with the dollar amount that your mom has. It has to do with how much your mom wants to protect Mary and this is important, listeners, protect the family. Because I have seen it in my own practice, brothers and sisters pulled apart over money. That when the inheritance comes in, the parent is gone, they were the glue holding the family together. Now the bickering and the infighting. And mom gave you this and I always wanted that. Mom told me I could have that. You manipulated her. I'm fighting this will. I've seen it. Mm-hmm. There's no fighting a trust. The trust is set up. It doesn't go through probate. A will would. And trying to do this with a will is going to be much more difficult. So I think you should talk with your mom about it. Try to involve a trust. It doesn't matter the dollar. You're saying, how much does it need to be for a trust to be worth it? If your mom is setting up the trust, there's no dollar amount. It's testamentary. It's created during life, funded at death. It's how involved does she want to be? Does she want to put $1,000 into this or $3,000? Because I think for what they're asking, from what I've seen Pete charging, and Pete's on the high end because he's that good, I think $1,000 to $3,000 is what an attorney will probably charge to put this together. It sounds complicated. It's not nearly as complicated to a good attorney.
Right, because they do these things all the time, so they're used to writing it. It's not like they're coming from scratch on all these things.
The only thing, and I know you're ready to hit the little thing. Oh, I'm not ready.
It. Oh, I'm hitting it.
You can't. I haven't answered the rest of his questions.
It'll play quietly in the background as you answer. As
I don't
reminder.
Have enough time. I will come back next week and pick up where we left off.
I can stop the music if you want.
Well, it was only should he use an income annuity or a trust. I just wanted to talk. Okay, good. You stopped the music. Okay, I bought myself about another minute. You don't need the income annuity on your side, and neither do your other siblings. The income annuity could definitely help on your spendthrift sister side, because even though a trust could be restricted to pay out just income, there's no guarantee on the performance of those investments. Let's go back to my $180,000 example. Your sister ends up with $180,000. You guys end up with $80,000 each. The trust passes all four other siblings. And again, I'm making that pot up. But four other siblings passes out. Now there's $180,000 in a trust. That trust, Chris, could be managed quite well and maybe could generate 3%, 4%, 5%, 6% interest a year. Or the trust could be mismanaged. Or she could live so long she outlives the income-producing ability of the trust, and there's no guarantees. If you want guarantees, you can say purchase an income annuity that will then pay however much it is capable of paying at Mary's inheritance, mm-hmm. the mother's death. The income annuity would...
Or at Mary's retirement. Oh, I think you wanted to fund
Mary's
retirement specifically.
Yeah. So it could be set up that way. The trust could be as flexible as to let the trustee decide based on Mary's life. You don't want to lock her into a lifetime income annuity. And when your mom dies 3 years later, Mary is diagnosed with cancer and has 6 months to live. Mm-hmm. What the hell good is the lifetime income stream going to be there? This decision needs to be made at the time, and that's what a trust can do, listener. So you would want the language of the trust to let the trustee decide, which will most likely be you and your other siblings, what's best for Mary. Well, if Mary has a long life expectancy, then an income annuity may make sense. And the trust buys it, that's all. Maybe half the trust should be an income annuity. The other half should be available for emergencies to Mary. Instead of putting it all in the income annuity, because you put it all in the income annuity, she can't get at it. So what I'm getting at, listener, is the trust is going to give you the flexibility you need not to make that decision today, but to make it in the future. Your mom just has to make sure that Mary's spendthrift provisions are the trustee has a right to decide if all or a portion of Mary's inheritance should be put in an income annuity or not. That's essentially what it should say. And then you make a decision at the time. Maybe interest rates are really low like they are now, Chris, and an income annuity isn't worth it. Maybe interest rates are back up to 9 or 10% and you buy an income annuity with a 10% interest rate, that's guaranteed forever. That just paid Mary a 10% interest payout for the rest of her life, guaranteed. Hey, that's pretty sweet. So maybe you should make that decision at that time. So you would write the trust with those provisions. My thought is a trust, but a trust at the mom level, not your level. That's my answer.
Perfect.
Okay, thank you.
You only went over by like 15 minutes.
Not bad.
Yeah. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us here on the Retirement and IRA Show. After our break here at the end, there'll be a one-minute pause, if you will, the pause being a little informational, I guess you could call it an advertisement, just a reminder of how you can get a hold of us. But then we'll immediately start playing the interview with Barry James from James Investment Research. So if you're interested in that at all, just hang out. Any parting words here, Jim?
Nope. We'll see you in a... Well, I'll see you when I come back from elk hunting. And we might be live or we might not be live.
Well, it'll be soon, though. We're
yes,
almost ready.
We're working there. We're almost there.
Perfect. See you next time.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
On today's show, we're going to be talking to Barry James from James Investment Research. Barry's going to be with us for his monthly visit, at least what we hope to be pretty much a monthly visit here on the Retirement and IRA Show. He's going to give us his opinions and kind of overview or recap of market activity and the state of the markets here as we see them today being, well, today when we're recording this is what, September 25th of 2017. This show will air on September 30th, so things can always happen in the next few days, but we'll have a little chat on what's going on as of today, September 25th, 2017. Jim's here in the office with me, so good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Jim, whatever the time of the day is.
It is afternoon, so good afternoon.
Right. So this is a Colorado edition of the Retirement and IRA Show, where we usually talk about things kind of specific to Colorado. Today we're not really talking specific Colorado items, as Barry's going to share his wisdom that's more nationally or globally based. But Jim, why don't you introduce Barry to the crowd here?
You have his bio.
Oh, I thought you said you had
no,
the bio.
No, I have it.
Oh,
I have
oh,
it.
This
well,
is organized.
You know me, I print everything out. Now I'm all set.
So here's a copy.
I have that as well, but excellent. I have all these pieces of paper in front of me, and my poor little iPad is acting as an easel holding everything up.
See, we want Barry to come back again.
Yeah, I know, so we have to look professional. But Barry James is the CEO of James Investment Research, and he's also the president of James Advantage Funds. He actually received his undergraduate degree right here in Colorado from the Air Force Academy down in Colorado Springs. So for all Colorado listeners, you all know where the springs are. It's south of Denver. And he has a master's degree from Boston University. And I'll give a shout-out. That is my alma mater for financial planning.
So there's a Colorado connection and
a
Boston,
connection.
He's perfect for the show.
He is. He's like we're best friends. He joined James Investment Research after a tour of duty as an instructor and fighter pilot with the U.S. Air Force. He returned to the company in 1986. He currently oversees the management of James Investment Research and is a senior member of the firm's investment committee. As a spokesman, he makes frequent national TV appearances on CNBC, MarketWatch, Fox Business, Bloomberg TV, as well as being quoted in Barron's, The Wall Street Journal, and numerous other financial publications. But he's probably most proud of having his second appearance on the Retirement and IRA Show. I mean, it stands to reason.
Hopefully he sees it the same way.
We'll soon find out. Barry, with that intro, are you here on the phone today with us?
I am, and I'm anxiously awaiting the program, that's for sure.
See, he's most proud of his appearance on our show.
Very nice. Yeah, we'll see if we can keep it that way.
But thanks for a return appearance. You had promised you'd be able to do this once a month, and we were wondering if after the first month you would run, but you didn't, so that's always a good sign. But where would you like to – I mean, I have a lot of questions that I want to ask you, I know. I know what we want to do is talk about investing. We're not going to pick any hot stocks or things of that nature, as you know, but we are going to talk in more generalizations where you see the stock market going, the bond market, and if you see that there's any value in anything, are you cautious across the board? I know last time that we spoke a month ago, you were talking a little bit about the breadth of the market or the lack of breadth in the market, and that the advance markets was relatively narrow. And I know you read Barron's and I read Barron's magazine, and it wasn't too long after that I was reading in Barron's. It was an older issue. I don't get to read them every month. They kind of build up in my kitchen, and then I get to them when I have a chance. But the article was a small little article, and it said bad breath, with breath being spelt with a D, right, Chris? D, yeah. for the breath of the market. And it was talking about the same thing you were talking about, that this advance was very narrow and the breath was very narrow, and that was troubling. Do you still see that over there at James?
We do to some extent. One of the key things that we look at beyond just the, you know, the number of stocks advancing versus declining is which stocks are advancing versus declining. And we have one of the strangest things going on this year that I've seen, and that is that companies that have no earnings, that are losing money, their stock price has been going up at a faster pace than companies that are actually profitable. Now, that makes no sense to anybody. Least of all me, and it's not obviously a sustainable situation, but that is something that would give me some concern, along with the fact that the market doesn't have the depth that we would certainly like to see.
Well, I know in your latest email, this is Monday. We are recording this on Monday, September 25th, and every Monday morning your firm sends out a market commentary. And it comes directly from your firm. I do encourage all our listeners, both in Colorado and those off of iTunes, to, especially if you're a do-it-yourself investor, subscribe to Barry's email newsletter. I find it very valuable. Where can people go again? Should they go to your main website, Barry, or is there a way to get this email sent to them?
Yes, www.jir-inc.com. And there's a little button there that you can select. And the best thing about this email, it's short.
It is.
You don't have a lot to read.
It kind of reminds me of me. It's very pithy and to the point.
Whoa. Let's not get carried away.
Well, I'm just saying. But one striking thing, and I'm going to read a little bit from your email that you talk about, because you break your email down into two simple sections, stock market analysis and bond market analysis. Doesn't get any simpler than that. In your stock market analysis, you're talking that there is caution. You are in a cautious mode, but you talked about sentiment. And you looked at the University of Michigan has many different surveys, and one is a consumer survey where they simply ask, do they feel stock prices will rise over the coming year or fall? And 65% of respondents believe stocks will be higher in a year. And you go on to point out that this is one of the highest levels of, I guess you could say, optimism since 2002. And you talk about an old saying that when everyone knows about the good deal, it's usually over. And then you went on in your email to talk about a few troubling, results. I don't think that's the right word, but a few troubling afterthoughts you can garner from such high optimism. And that in the past you wrote, when you see the market at this level of optimism, 96% of the time over the next 12 months, the market has been down. I thought that was very striking.
It is, and maybe a little unnerving. I don't want people to think that that's a prediction, but that is a historical fact. We found that correlation historically. And the combination of things that you mentioned, the sentiment being too high, and then also what I just mentioned about the market being upside down, companies that don't make much sense to own their shares have been outperforming those that make all the sense in the world, those that are cheap and with good earnings. And then we have valuations that are very high at this juncture as well. We're finding fewer and fewer what we would call bargains. At a market peak, you know, we went back and looked at several market peaks, and we found that about roughly a third of the time, a third of the stocks were cheap with a price relative to earnings below average, below 15. Today, that number is about 1 in 4. So there's much fewer that are in that cheap range, and so that's kind of disturbing to us as well. And those things, you know, all kind of fit together into that mosaic where the market historically has been down in the next 12 months. And the sad news is that we've never seen a period where it was up over 10%. So even if it does rise, it doesn't rise very much.
Well, with that in mind, as you look out, how could the Federal Reserve, could they help or hurt this situation? Do you think with the actions that the Fed has taken in the past with their quantitative easing, and now everybody is saying that they're going to have to start unwinding their balance sheet, do you see the Federal Reserve impacting any of this at all?
We certainly do. You know, the hike in short-term interest rates, which is really the only thing the Federal Reserve can control. It does not control long-term interest rates. But they expect to be up to 1.4 or 1.5% by the end of the year, and they have stated that they would like to see it over 2% by the end of next year. And that impact is obviously better for savers because they make a little bit more money on their savings account, maybe getting even with the rate of inflation. However, when they raise rates, it doesn't necessarily mean the stock market goes down, but the research we've done shows that it goes up at a slower pace than when they're cutting rates. And then the last thing that we were talking about, where the Federal Reserve has $4.5 trillion of bonds that it has bought with its magic credit card with, there's no limit to it. And they can buy whatever they want with it. And so they've done that. And now they're looking to do something instead of quantitative easing. They're calling it quantitative tightening. And while, the Fed chairwoman says that, it's going to look like paint drying or feel like it, they're going to start to allow bonds to mature and they won't turn around and buy them again, which is what they've been doing, which has undergirded this market. And what is astonishing, some of the different research I've seen says that over 90% of the market advance since 2008 is directly correlated to this quantitative easing. And if we do the opposite of quantitative easing, that will have repercussions through the market in some significant ways.
So how would that work? I can tell you how to handle an inherited IRA from a non-spousal beneficiary with a trust. I can't tell you a lot of this investment nuance. That's why we have Travis Rash, who works for us, a CFA, and that's why we have you come on and talk. But if the Fed is going to allow their bond book to mature, what are they going to do with that money as they're being paid the principal?
Well, it goes to pay off their magic credit card.
Effectively disappears.
That's the best way I can
right.
put it.
Exactly.
They've taken it on their books, as a debt and as an asset.
It's now, a debt and gained, an asset?
Well, yeah.
Well, on their balance sheet.
On the balance sheet? Okay.
Yeah. So it's a remarkable thing. They borrowed the money out of thin air to buy these. So I guess the payments go back into thin air. I'm not sure.
So, but that money is coming out of the system, would it not?
It is, but it isn't. What happens is their plan is to allow bonds to mature. So say a bond next month matures. They're not going to go and buy a similar bond again. They're just going to let it mature. And so it rolls off. Now, the Treasury will still issue a bond because they need the money because we run lots of deficits in this country. And when they issue that bond, somebody will buy it. Now, fortunately, the size of the bond market is so large that there will be somebody that will come along and buy it. They just don't have the Fed there, trying to buy it as well, which tends to keep interest rates down
Which everybody knows, the Fed has been a very large buyer. They're not just any old buyer, of course.
No, $4.5 trillion is a lot.
They're a large buyer out in the. So when they step off and they can stop buying these things, that it would generally have upward pressure on interest rates. But they have also admitted that, Barry, you may probably be getting to this, that they said, well, on the other hand, we still have this other dial where we can affect short-term rates to maybe lessen the blow if we see the negative effects of this quantitative tightening affecting things. Do you think they're really going to be able to balance those things out?
No.
No, yeah, I didn't think so either.
they have never been successful with this in the past.
Right.
The quantitative easing was supposed to have caught, supercharged the economy, and it didn't work. We've had excessively slow growth. I'm not blaming it necessarily, but it didn't accomplish what it was hoped to do. And what it did, yes, interest rates have stayed down, but it's not directly tied with that. Every time they did active quantitative easing, we saw interest rates rise. And when they stopped, interest rates fell. So that got kind of funky there. But the rest of the world said, hey, this is good for stock prices, so we'll do it too. So you still have a lot of money sloshing around over in Europe and in China and other countries, Japan as well. So, everybody tries to do something, and, generally it didn't work for the first person, but the other people don't discover until it's too late.
Interesting, but again, I guess I still can't wrap my mind around. So the Fed holds a bond. They're not going to reinvest that money, and now they have it. Do they have to give it? I know they have to give their profits to the U.S. Treasury. Do they give the return of principal, which essentially is coming from the U.S. Treasury? Most of their bonds are Treasury bonds they owned. So the government, the U.S. Treasury, gives them, let's just say they got a $1 billion bond that's maturing, gives them $1 billion. The Federal Reserve is not going to take that billion and go out and buy another bond with it. So at the end of the quarter, do they then give it to the Treasury as a profit?
No.
No?
No.
No, not the principal part.
Not the principal?
No.
It just disappears.
Well, it was created out of thin air, so it gets sucked back into thin air.
It's like a black hole. It's sucking it back in.
Yeah, it's essentially...
It's a great credit card to have. I wish I had one of those.
It's a credit card, and they have the magic credit card, and then they have the magic eraser as well.
That's right.
Interesting.
It doesn't make any sense.
I mean, y'all are laughing at this, but it could force us into a recession. Of course, Trump will get blamed for it, but it could force us into a recession.
Impossible. Yeah, let's hope not. That's not the goal.
I'm just saying, anything that happens, he's going to get blamed for it, even if it's the Fed that caused it. But interesting.
I think underlying in all of this, Jim, is the fact that stocks and bonds are going to trade more on their real value than on this make-believe. And pardon the pun, but this quantitative easing has trumped all the normal methodologies you use for figuring out what investments are really worth. And so we're just going to be going back to normal. So there's been this buildup to some extent in the market that is, a kind of an underlying bubble, if you will. Companies with no earnings that are very richly priced have been just doing fantastic. You think of a Tesla or something like that. And yet those companies, solid little companies that just, make profit at quarter after quarter, they've been completely ignored. That's going to change. And that's going to be a real opportunity if you're a do-it-yourselfer. That's where opportunity comes into being.
Well, you forget the magic words, though. This time is different.
Oh, I hope not. I hope not.
I mean, that's how they defended the 90s until that didn't work anymore.
That's right.
But if what you're saying is true, and I don't doubt it, and we're going to start valuing companies again based on more traditional metrics, not these fantasy metrics, what risks do you then see in the stock and bond markets, for that matter, coming, and what can investors do about them?
Well, the risks are that people who have really gone whole hog on things like exchange-traded funds, passive investing, and just buying an index fund are going to see some changes because, again, the money when you buy an index, the most of the money goes into the very largest positions. And if you think of Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, they call that FANG. It's almost 8% of the market value of the S&P 500. So every dollar that goes in that, 8 cents goes into those four stocks alone. So that won't be as attractive. All that's to say, that's not going to be as attractive as it once was because those are very expensive companies. Nothing wrong with them. They're just expensive. So that will start to shed its skin. And the other thing we'll start to see, I believe, is that the growth types of companies, won't be as favored as they have been in the last 10 years. Large caps won't be as favored as they were in the last few years. So we'll see this switching over to smaller cap and to more value oriented. And that's the way to really try and approach this. Is hopefully there's an opportunity. We saw it in 1999, and then into 2000, we had that upside down market all over again, then maybe even more so than now. And then we saw this value and smaller stocks do well from 2000 to 2002, when the stock market itself was heading the other way, as the internet bubble kind of unwound.
Well, some of our listeners may not quite know what you mean by growth and value. And one of the things that always get me as someone who, I don't manage money, I manage expectations. We use firms to manage money, and that's what your firm does. But one of the things that always confuses me, or as I read prospectuses, I'm one of the few that probably actually read them, you can clearly see in the growth and value argument that saying, just like you had a saying earlier that when everybody knows about it, it's probably over. I have a saying that one man's treasure is another man's trash. And where do you draw the line? A growth stock is a stock that, I guess at its most fundamental level, some people, yourself included, might argue a growth stock is overvalued from a valuation standpoint. You'd be paying too much for it. You're paying full retail, so to speak. Whereas a value stock is one that is trading at less than intrinsic value. In other words, it's on sale. But isn't that an objective determination based on each manager?
You've got it right. It depends on how you define growth and how you define value. We try to find bargains. We want relatively cheap companies. So we look at traditional valuation methodologies, and they're not very helpful in the short run in terms of predicting the stock price. But they're very, very helpful over, a multi-year period. And so we're trying to look beyond that. So we look at what do you pay for $1 worth of earnings. In a company like Amazon, you're paying hundreds of dollars for $1 worth of earnings, meaning it would take you hundreds of years before you got paid back the money in earnings as an owner of the company. That is based off of the expected improvement in the company, that the earnings would continue to grow at a very rapid pace and lower that valuation. So you can look at it for versus earnings. You can look at it versus what the accountants say the value of the company is. You can look at it versus sales, and we take a whole smattering of those, and we're looking for companies that are cheaper than the market. And part of the reason for that is if the market does go down, those don't tend to go down as much. But the other side of the equation is we do want companies that are actually profitable. We're not going to buy those companies that are unprofitable. That's not a very good way of investing. Maybe it was this year, or has been so far this year, but it always plays out in the end that companies have to have earnings for people really to want to own them. So the side of growth is focused on how rapid will those earnings rise, and what are the expectations of them rising? So it doesn't base anything on the value of the company today. It's all about the future. And sometimes it gets it right, and sometimes it gets it wrong. But people always like a great story, and growth stocks generally have the great stories, while value stocks don't have much of a story at all.
Right. Growth stocks get all the attention, and they do. They get all the hoopla, all the attention. It's kind of like the guy who drives around in a fancy sports car, and then someone else driving around in a more stodgy
work truck
yeah. Isn't going to get much attention. But interesting. When we come back, because we got Barry for one more segment, we're going to look at a few more questions. I want to ask him some common mistakes that investors are susceptible to and how to avoid them. And I also am going to ask him, it's fine to give us a projection of what he thinks over the next year, but let's try to get his opinion on where he sees things maybe over the next five or more years. So we'll cover those when we come back.
Excellent. So once again, we've got Barry James from James Investment Research going to continue with us after this short break. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear one of the top songs from 1935 as we look back to the year that Social Security started. We do talk about Social Security a fair amount on the show, just not today, but we're going to keep our habit of playing one of those sweet songs from 1935. So we'll be back with you right after this short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. We are joined today with Barry James from James Investment Research. And that song that we heard coming in from the break there is You Are My Lucky Star by Eddie Duchesne and his orchestra back in 1935. Very popular tune. I'm not going to give you all the details on that because this is kind of a special show. We're back here with, like I said, with Barry James. So we want to get to him as soon as possible. So welcome back, Barry.
Hi, good to be with you.
Excellent. Jim, what, I guess we kind of ended perfectly on a topic, but do you have any extension on the topic we ended with, or are you on to the next one with Barry?
No, I just, I thought you were going to let Barry try to guess the song.
Well, we can, well, it's too late now because I already announced
You already announced it.
I guess.
I'm lucky you did.
Come on, you haven't sharpened up on your 1935 music?
Popular songs from 1935.
Did you tell our listeners why we go back to 1935 and do that?
Well, before we left, because we talk about Social Security. That is the year that Social Security
was created. Yes. Yeah,
August specifically was when it was signed into law. So we're a little bit past, 82 years
82,
now.
82, yes. But we do want to welcome back our Northern Colorado listeners. You're paying attention to us at on KFKA on a Saturday morning. We are recording this on Monday the 25th, even though it is Saturday the 30th. And we have no idea what the weather is, but I believe, based on the five-day forecast I saw this morning, Chris, it is supposed to be a fine 70-ish kind of weather day in Colorado. So people should be getting ready for a beautiful day this morning.
Fine fall weather. Perfect
fall
time
weather.
In Colorado.
It's
yes.
going to be beautiful, beautiful. But how is the weather on Saturday in Ohio supposed to be? Do you know, Barry?
I think it's supposed to be the same. It's been very hot here lately, but it's supposed to be cooling off. So hopefully you're sending us that cool weather.
Oh, hopefully we are. Okay, so at the end of the last segment, I mentioned that you were going to share with us some common mistakes that investors usually make and what they could do to be able to avoid them. Do you want to start sharing some of the mistakes people make and then maybe share some solutions on how to avoid them?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. You know, we're all human and we're all prone to make mistakes anyways, but there are some that tend to be more common when it comes to investing. And the first thing I always start off talking with folks about in this, and I do cover these in my little book that I have, Seven Timeless Principles of Investing. It is on Amazon for not a lot of money. But anyways, the first one is not matching your investments up to your personality, to who you are. And that's really, really crucial. So if you're a real conservative person and you can't stand losing money, to be in very aggressive types of investments, you're going to not have much success sleeping at night. And the first time that they go down by a large measure, you're going to be jumping out, which is probably the exact wrong time to do that. But, you know, it's only human nature that if it doesn't really match who you are. So in my book, and I'm sure you probably have similar things, Jim, you have something that can help people to find their risk tolerances and possibly what type of investments would best fit them. And that's a crucial thing to getting started on the right foot. And in this business, you have to stay with something for a while. You can't just jump from one thing to another. And that's most often what people are doing because they haven't fit their investments to really who they are.
Yeah, this is actually something that I want to dedicate an entire show to. I haven't had a chance yet to be able to do it. And then this week we ended up getting actually 7 email questions in that we're going to be addressing on our podcast version of the Retirement and IRA Show. But recently the Wall Street Journal dedicated a very big section. It was either last Saturday or the Saturday before to helping people determine your risk tolerance. But not only that, highlighting how a lot of advisors, a lot of financial advisors are making mistakes in the way that they help people assess risk. And the biggest thing I've always said, and one of the reasons as a firm we do not use risk tolerance questionnaires, is if I sat someone down at my desk, give them a nice cup of coffee, maybe a cup of tea or water to the other one, have some nice gentle music playing in the background, everything is peaceful and smooth, and I say, gee, Mr. and Mrs. Client, can you please fill in this risk tolerance questionnaire so I can determine how you're going to act when all hell is breaking loose? And people are going to sit there with a rational mind and complete something, but when all hell is breaking loose, they have an irrational mind and the two don't compute together. And that's the problem with a risk tolerance questionnaire. It's no different than when I used to be a police officer, or probably when you used to fly fighter jets. Yours is probably a lot more terrifying than me being a cop. But we would role play in the academy different scenarios. You knew they were fake. You're role playing them with, this is before computers, so we didn't have any of the computer training like they do today, so it may be different. But we're sitting across from, you know, our cubicle mate, and he's pretending to be this mean guy, and I'm supposed to be role playing, and that's preparing me. So you're in a very rational situation, and then all of a sudden in the real world, when I'm dealing with someone who's fighting and angry, it was totally different. And I'm sure when you were training to be a fighter pilot, it was totally different than if you were actually flying a combat mission. Just it helps you, but it's not really the same. And at least that's how I look at risk tolerance questionnaires. What are your thoughts on that, Chris?
No, it is. It's hard to – humans have a really inadequate skill generally at putting themselves in hypothetical situations and judging how they're going to react, especially when it's something that's tied so much to an irrational behavior like emotions. So I'm not a big fan of the questionnaires either. I think it's more rational to look at their risk capacity and where they have risk exposures and help talk through where they should be exposed and where they shouldn't be exposed, and can they handle the exposures they've got? Because so many decisions now are made in a status of kind of risk ignorance, in my opinion, where people don't really understand the risk they're exposed to and how it would affect them personally.
Yeah, what we try to do, Barry, is we pay a lot of attention with our clients to risk capacity. And now, granted, our clientele is a little different than the typical office because retirement planning is all we do. So the vast, vast majority of our clients are 50 and above, with a lot of them being 55 and above and ready to retire. And we get them to understand risk capacity, the ability of a portfolio to weather a loss, and you not having to change your current lifestyle is far more important than how you're going to be feeling at 3 a.m. Granted, I do worry about how my clients are going to feel at 3 a.m, but I don't wake up at 3 a.m. wondering, gee, I'm wondering what Mr. and Mrs. Jones are doing right now, if they're panicking. But I may wake up at 3 a.m. and wonder, gee, can Mr. and Mrs. Jones pay next month's mortgage bill because of this massive drop in the market? Risk capacity is a measure that looks at, will you have to alter your lifestyle if your portfolio falls significantly? And if the answer to that is no, because either the people have a lot of money in very safe assets, or they've built a lot of protections, or they have a lot of lifetime income that doesn't get cut if the market's down, we tell them you can take far more investment risk if you have a lot of risk capacity. But if you don't have a lot of risk capacity, you can't take a lot of investment risk. And that begins to sink in for people. And it doesn't matter to just retirees. If someone who's, if a 30-year-old comes to me and says, hey, Jim, I have $200,000 and I want to buy a house in 2 years with it. What should I do with the money? Telling them, Chris, to go, well, gee, go buy stocks. They're at an all-time high. This is great. Is probably not what we're going to say.
Not probably not. That's absolutely not what we're going to say, right?
Because a significant drop in their portfolio would cause problems. They may not be able to buy the house that they want to buy if their $200,000 is suddenly worth $100,000. They can buy a house, probably just not the house they wanted to. It's going to be a lot smaller. But
one thing you bring up there that is always the bottom line truth is risk is the risk of losing capital.
Yeah, it's not
People define it other ways, but it's always about losing money, and that's what folks really need to have a focus. I love what you're talking about with risk capacity is how much can you lose and still be okay.
Exactly, and I often said to people, no one has ever sued an advisor for making them too much money. You kind of get sued if you lose too much money. Okay, so what else are the common mistakes that you see people making?
Well, one is something that happens all too often, especially at markets at extremes, and that is everyone's following the crowd. You know, we've said that, you know, when everyone's discovered it, it's too late. The good deal's already been gone. But, you know, you think back into the late 90s, it was technology and internet stocks. And I remember we lost a lot of our business because we wouldn't buy companies with no earnings. And those companies didn't have earnings. Now, of course, they fell 80-90% in the 3 years, you know, when the internet bubble blew up. But that's one thing. And then, you know, you had gold. That became the little mania, if you will. And now it's kind of what I call this massive passive push, people just putting their money passively into stocks without, you know, looking at, you know, the individual securities and what they're really worth. And just to go along with that, to recognize a mania, there's a couple of things that go along with it. One is that the underlying asset, the price rises, but it's not really associated with any economic reasons for that. Number two, that everybody finds a way to then be able to buy it. They talk about Joe Sixpack or whatever. Everybody can then get into this particular investment. I remember going by gas station, seeing gold for sale at a gas station. I'm like, what? And then thirdly, anybody that dare says a word against it is considered an idiot. And I remember being told that in the late 90s, you know, that we'd lost it, that we didn't know what we were doing, that, you know, this is the new thing, just the number of eyeballs, that's all that a stock had to be valued on. So those three things give you a heads up whether something is really, really not a good time to chase. But all your friends are saying, you better buy this, or all your friends are saying, look how well I'm doing, and trying to get you to kind of follow along with that. And that's one of the worst things that folks can do.
All your friends, Barry, then, are saying, this time is different, Barry. You just don't get it. This time. But for those who don't understand what Barry meant by eyeballs, back in the late 90s when he was managing assets, a lot of new companies for the internet were being valued not by showing profits and actually making money, but by how many visitors, unique visitors, to their websites that they had. And companies were just being valued if they'd release every quarter. We had 16 million, I'm making that number up, but 16 million unique visitors to our website, and then all of a sudden their stock price would double or triple because more people are going to it. They're still not making any money, but the theory was so many people are going to it that eventually they'll make money. Well, the reality is they never did, and they fell out of favor, and people lost a lot of money. Well, the mantra back then that value investors such as Barry were being chastised for is that they didn't see that this time was different. And you shouldn't use traditional stock valuations. You needed to use new valuation metrics such as eyeballs. And that's how they came up with that.
Exactly what happened. Yeah, that was.
And how'd that work out?
Interesting time. An interesting time.
But do you feel, or do you, because I know you as a value investor, Barry, which means, again, you don't overpay for stocks. You essentially like to buy stocks on sale. Are you finding that same mantra being batted around that this time is different?
Yes. Yes, we do. We've seen that in the 18 months from the end of 2015 through the middle of 2017. We've seen companies that would be the worst things. We would never, ever own them. Terrible earnings, terrible valuations, and they've been doing poorly, the stocks had. Those have been the ones that have gone up. They've gone up three times the rate of those really cheap, inexpensive companies with good earnings. three times the rate, and that's pretty frustrating. And I'm hearing some folks say, "Well, I can go make 15% over here buying this, you know, this hot idea or whatever." I want to share with them, no, you probably won't, but bless you, and I hope it works out for you. When people start chasing after these things, and they're chasing after returns, it doesn't work. There's Confucius had a saying, the man who chases two rabbits catches neither. And that's the problem when you chase returns. You're never going to catch it because you'll always be one step behind chasing the hot item. And you really need to stay with a good discipline. And that's where an advisor like your group really is a benefit to folks. Keep you on track, keep you in the game, even when things seem to be completely out of focus.
Well, I've often said, and I say to clients, we don't manage money. We manage expectations. We don't sit here picking the individual stocks and bonds. We will pick the individual diversified investment options. Lately, that could be an index fund or it could be a mutual fund or whatever, an ETF, whatever we may use. But we don't pick the individual stocks and bonds that are within those different assets. And I spend my time managing expectations, managing human behavior, which is far more, I think, difficult than actually managing money. Money operates by certain rules. Sometimes it gets stretched by valuations and gets pulled by fear and greed, which is essentially the two biggest human emotions. But we deal with human emotions more than we deal with assets. I use people like you and others to manage the actual money. Just like you wouldn't know how to do my job, I often say I wouldn't know how to do your job.
Well, I think we better stay to our own jobs.
Stay to our own jobs. Okay, well, before we wrap up, why don't you give us a little, what is that, prognostication? Is that the word I'm looking for?
Sure.
Looking towards the future?
Yes.
Yeah. Where do you see things going 5 years, 10 years from now, especially in light of the fact that we have a Congress that can't get anything done? We're politically divided in this country. We're becoming emotionally divided in this country. You're either with us or you're against us, and that's what everybody is saying. I see the country being torn apart with strife more than anything. But where do you see things going over the next 5 years?
Well, when it comes down to it, it's always going to follow the economy, stocks will eventually reflect the reality of the economy. It may not be as strong as the stock market has been showing, and that's why valuations are helpful. We look at some very, very long-term valuations worth against 10 years worth of earnings or against replacing a company's value, and they would say over the next 5 years, don't expect a lot. You've got your job cut out for you if you're managing expectations, because it would say historically 1-3% annualized returns over the next 5 years. Now, that does not include all areas of the stock market. And you can see, as I've mentioned before, these areas that have been ignored, as I mentioned, those that are deep values, that are deep bargains, maybe even smaller stocks, they will probably do better in the end. And I really do believe that small stocks will have a very, very nice run. We saw this kind of that period from 2000 to 2007, it was a period for small and for value to run, and they just did fantastically well. So I think we're building towards that. I can't say the date that it would happen, but I would imagine within the next 12 months we're going to see this shifting, and maybe because of what the Federal Reserve is doing or something else. But that's kind of what we see there. Bonds are a good offset to the risks that you have in stocks. They probably won't make a lot of money because they don't have a lot of yield at this time. But we don't see that you'll lose a lot of money. We don't have inflation picking up its ugly head at this point, and I think the Federal Reserve has a pulse on that. So the other side of the equation is if you're looking for cheaper, international is in many ways cheaper than what we have in the United States. We've kind of defied gravity for some time, but there's some cheap foreign countries that you can buy into, and that would probably be a wise type of investment to have.
Interesting. So if someone, because you just said 1-3% expected return, are you talking a 60-40 portfolio or just U.S. stocks, and in that one you're looking at more of overvalued stocks, or is that how do you come up with that 1 to 3? Because I run into this. Remember, I said I manage expectations, not money. What we do, what our investment committee does here as a firm, and Travis, you've never spoken to or met Travis yet, Barry, but maybe someday you can. One of the things he helps us do as a firm is gives us forward-looking expectations for our 5 different models of risk, from conservative all the way up to aggressive. And as I've often said to clients, when you drive home, you will be looking through the windshield, not your rearview mirror. So when we work with people, we get them to understand, we don't look at past performance. We don't say, hey, here's how these investments have performed over the last decade. This is why you want to buy them. As you said, by then it's too late. You're a day late and a dollar short. This is what you could have done. Instead, what we look for is looking forward, what might be coming. So just to take a moderate portfolio, for instance, Travis's latest forward-looking projections is only 4.25% for a moderate portfolio, and that's before inflation adjustments. And that's a 60-40 forward-looking portfolio, 60% equities, 40% bonds, using Morningstar's current moderate benchmark. So he gets the allocation from Morningstar, but looks forward. And I've had clients look at me and say, how can you be projecting such a low return? Look at what, everything is just so good. Everything just keeps going up. How can you just say it's going to be 4.25? And I try to get them to, I'd say to them, because this is what Travis is telling me, he says that a lot of what the Fed has done is simply rob future returns and pull it more towards the present. Do you feel the same, and is that how you came up with your low projections?
Yes, we do feel the same. What we looked at was historically going back to the 50s and looking at the Standard & Poor's 500 index. And when these particular valuation methodologies were saying stocks were cheap, you saw 10 to 12%. And that was true at the end of 2008. It said stocks were cheap for the next 5 years, and those are the types of returns we saw. On the other end of the spectrum, when they get very, very expensive, they're much higher than average. That's when you see that 1 to 3% in stocks alone. You add bonds in and you tend to do better, is what we found, because you don't have the big swings. And when the market does go down, you don't fully participate. So I wouldn't disagree with that analysis that you folks have done. And, the Federal Reserve has pulled returns from the future to what we've already seen, and it always plays catch up in the end.
So what do you think wakes Janet Yellen up at 3 a.m?
She's probably wondering if you're awake, Jim.
Is Jim sleeping? Janet Yellen, for our listeners who don't know, she's the chairwoman of the Federal Reserve. But what do you think scares the Fed the most? Do you have any idea?
Oh yeah, that it would be a bubble exploding. They've built an asset bubble, as they did with the real estate market, up to about 2006, 2007, and as they did with technology, and we even saw it in 1987, where they had, that was the first wave of all these people buying index funds, and it was this perpetual motion machine, which the Fed then cut off. So that's got to be our biggest worry. And then, besides that, it's they want inflation. I know this sounds crazy. They want inflation because inflation actually reduces how much in today's dollars you have to pay in the future. And so just 4% a year inflation over 15 years cuts what we pay back in the debt from $20 trillion down to $10 trillion in today's dollars. So, they do want to see inflation, but they certainly don't want to see it getting out of hand.
Interesting. Well, Barry, as always, I know this is only the second time having you on the show. We really enjoyed it, and I'm hoping our listeners do. This will play again Saturday in Northern Colorado, and it's also going to play on our iTunes podcast that will also appear sometime after this Saturday, the 30th. So thanks again, Barry, and we hope to get you back on the show in another month.
It's a real pleasure.
Okay. Thanks, Barry. Have a good
Barry.
Afternoon.
Okay.
Well, that does it for the Retirement and IRA Show for this week. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.